Some of the way, reacting to external demands for instruction rather than in ways determined by his own interests and energies and power. He says we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. For Humboldt, then, man is born to inquire and create. And when a man or a child chooses to inquire or create out of his own free choice, then he becomes in his own terms an artist rather than a tool of production or a well-trained parent.
Hello and welcome to the 96th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. The guest this week is the Marxist autodidact and YouTube star Brendan Cooney. And we discuss nothing other than the theories of that big German guy Karl Marx. Brendan and I spoke for about 2 hours last week, so this will be a two-part episode. And if some of you are squirming at the prospect, I just hope that I can convince you to give it a chance. Cooney is a very accessible and entertaining thinker and pedagogue. It's Thursday, March 24th, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast. I want to thank everyone who has communicated with me about the podcast through Facebook and Twitter over the last week, and of course by email. And I want to say a special thanks to Dominic, who sent me a music file with clips of Carlos Castaneda. Very cool. My Twitter name is just Doug Lane as one word, and I'm the Douglas Lane in Portland, Oregon. I'll also point out that you can sign up for email alerts about Diet Soap through the DietSoapCast.com blog, or through DouglasLane.com or DietSoap.Podomatic.com. In other Lane-related news, my short story, The Last Apollo Mission, is available at FLIRB. What is FLIRB? It's an online zine of astonishing tales, usually edited and published by Rudy Rucker, but this month edited by the short story writer Eileen Gunn. It's free, and I'll put a link in the show notes, along with a link to Brendan Cooney's blog, Capitalism 101. Right now you're listening to Magic Fly by the 70s group Space. But in just a moment, you'll be learning about real value with Brendan Cooney. The YouTube star Brendan Cooney has produced over 100 YouTube videos on the subject of Marxist economics and Marxist theories. The videos are really a series of lectures illustrated by the kinds of visual montages that are only possible in this internet age. With titles like Law of Value and the Fetishism of Commodities, you might think his work would be dry, but instead he presents these videos and ideas in a lucid and accessible and entertaining way. So do you have anything you want to add to that bio? It's pretty sketchy there.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the nice thing about the internet is you can be as sketchy as possible and get away with it, I guess. And I'm flattered to be a YouTube star in a few people's eyes. My own perception, I feel like I dwell in a sort of obscure corner of cyberspace, but at least some people have found my videos a little bit helpful in this pressing project of our time, trying to make sense of the world we live in and how we might go about changing it at some point.
Well, I was going to say you need more kittens on your videos if you want to be a big name, but then I realized that you actually have a video with a large kitten section. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I do have a few kitten sequences, but they still haven't gotten me the sort of viral. I haven't linked into that sort of viral kitten thing. Yeah, I'm working.
Yeah, got to make them shorter, man. That's the thing for that. So just to start with, are you an instructor or a professor in your for your day job?
Yeah, I love that people ask me that all the time, and it's so flattering because I have no academic credentials at all. Aside from like a bachelor's degree where I read a lot of Marx, I'm a musician and I teach music to high school and middle school students. I play a lot of music, but my interest in Marx is purely of an autodidactic nature. It's actually a little bit liberating because, you know, it's studying Marx in the academy in America is not an easy thing to do. And if you're going to do it, there are probably only a few schools where you can do it, and you probably are not going to be able to do it in economics. You're going to do it in philosophy, and you're going to have to read a lot of other stuff first. before you get to read the stuff you actually want to read. So I can, not being an academic, I can pursue my own course of reading. And this blogging project, both my written blog and my YouTube videos, are great because they give me a way to, as I'm working through things and reading things, I sort of have a sounding board to try to put my ideas into some sort of cohesive format. So it's been a learning process for me, too, as I've made this journey through Marxist theory to share it with other people and try to work on sort of a Marxist pedagogy.
Your comment about being liberated from the academy struck me as particularly true. In America, a lot of the kind of Marxism that you can find is going to be tinged by the Frankfurt School and cultural studies and cultural theory, which is all very interesting. But and you heard that interview I did with Martin Jay.
Yeah, right.
And I think all of that is kind of a Marxism in retreat. Mm-hmm. And I like getting to the core of his economic ideas because I think it leads to a lot of other – it has a lot of implications. His economic ideas have a lot of implications. And I think they're the kind of things we need to consider right now. So let me ask you, what are your politics? Obviously, you're interested in Marx. Do you belong to any specific Marxist party or group like the ISO or the SWP?
No, that's also one of the most frequent questions I get. And no, I don't belong to any political groups. I have never really felt moved to belong to any of them. I guess in the same way that you were saying the Frankfurt School is a symbol of the left in decline, I feel like a lot of these small sectarian groups, and it's not as a slight to any of their members or anything, because I think they're actually a lot of brilliant people working in those groups and dedicated people. But I feel like sort of the dynamics of like the sectarian left are definitely a sign of a left in decline. And they've never really attracted me as a sort of never seemed like a particularly constructive lot to cast myself in with, at least at this point in history. So I'm doing this project of my own, which is sort of a pedagogical project, and I'm not saying that that's some sort of revolutionary act. But so the only constructive thing I've been able to come up with to do in my life is for someone who's interested in Marx.
I don't know if it's revolutionary. We'll have to wait and see, I guess. It certainly is interesting and I think helpful. So let's just get to the Marx.
Let's get Marx.
About a decade ago, I encountered an anarchist writer on indie media who was very concerned about peak oil. And this is a question that's leading into kind of the labor theory of value. So I don't recall his specialty, but he approached politics and economics as energy systems rather than social systems. And I recall that a few Marxist critics responded to his concerns about falling energy supplies and how it could lead to an authoritarian state, saying that he didn't understand economics, that value in an economic system like ours was created by labor and not energy and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So is that are they being too ideological, these Marxist critics, or what is the relationship between real values, like, say, the use value of oil and labor value?
That's an interesting question. There, you could perform any sort of mental or philosophical abstraction and measure, create some sort of metric to measure any sort of political or economic phenomena through any metric. You could measure it through energy, utility, vibrations, colors. But the sort of abstractions that Marx is interested in doing when analyzing economics and politics, real abstractions that capital makes. Capital doesn't care about the social usefulness of the things it's creating. It only cares about the self-expansion of value. That is, investing money, which is the abstract measure of value, in order to create more money. And this sort of constantly expanding value is what capital is all about. You could create metrics to measure sort of the way energy is used in economies, but those are sort of just metrics for like philosophers to think about. They don't actually portray the real process that's going on in the capitalist economy. In fact, the reason we have an ecological crisis is because capital doesn't take any of these other things into consideration when it's investing. If it's profitable to raise the global climate temperatures, then that's what will happen. If it's not profitable, it won't happen. So there's sort of a limit to doing these other sorts of abstractions that aren't that are just sort of purely in the mind. They can't really explain much of the actual economic process that is leading to the ecological crisis that we're in today. You know, it's also an interesting question about, and this is something I think Marxist theory has not had to really grapple or think about until the past maybe a couple of decades. Marx was very interested in identifying internal limits to capitalist expansion. He saw there were internal contradictions in a capitalist society that caused it to have these really extreme cycles of boom and bust and of economic crisis like we have now and economic expansion. And that these cycles, some people previous to Marx wanted to explain these things by like the natural returns to agricultural production or limits to population. But Marx wanted to say that these things are actually internal to capitalism. Today, for the first time really in history, we actually have this idea of so these questions about the external limits to capital. People are saying, can capital survive global warming? Can it survive? I actually think the answer is still that yes, it can. That environmental catastrophe is often really good for capital. I mean, what were people saying when the tsunami hit Japan last week? They were saying, this is going to have a temporary, a few years, it's going to be really bad for the Japanese economy, but then it's going to be really good. There's going to be huge room for growth and investment. For the same reason that World War II got us out of the Great Depression, that we just destroyed a lot of stuff in World War II. There were just massive amounts of destruction. That's always good for capitalism. The same way Hurricane Katrina was really good for the New Orleans economy. It was able to take off on this aggressive sort of neoliberal restructuring of the city, rebuilding things and zoning poor people out of the city and all this stuff. I think the only way the environmental catastrophe would be bad for capitalism if it destroyed human civilization, if we all died or something. Then, maybe we would have an end to capitalism because of environmental catastrophe. But short of that, I think environmental destruction is always going to be good.
They were supposed to be celebrating White Day when men give presents to the women they love. But the supermarket shelves are destroyed and the customers gone. It's just a small example of the blow to the heart of the world's third largest economy.
But the stress of that ordeal and the size of the waves that came were just a tiny reflection of what's still unfolding in Japan, where tonight nuclear officials there are warning of a possible nuclear reactor meltdown.
The destruction of capital is the mechanism that causes the rebound. Fundamentally, there are other things going on, but the particular form that this takes is historically specific, and last time it took a very, very destructive, antisocial form, and that's something I think we have to be worried about right now.
The problem with creative destruction is that it is destruction.
They have been watching three facilities near the epicenter with concern all day, and at one of them, fuel rods are now exposed, and if they stay that way, they could release radioactivity and a disaster of unknown proportions.
They wear hazmat suits that protect airways but do little to stop potentially fatal doses of radiation. These brave, nameless men stand ready to lay down their lives to slay a fire-breathing dragon.
The communists, when things obviously didn't function in communist regimes, they reasoned exactly in the same way. They said, no, this is not the crisis of the communist system. It's because we were not pure enough as communists. We had too much, we allowed too many capitalist elements and so on and so on. Here is the same. This is the fundamentalist answer. You never admit that the system is wrong. You try to put the blame on how we were not faithful enough to the fundamentals of the system. So again, at least one thing we should admit. The crisis that we have now is the crisis of liberal capitalism.
Japan's central bank responded by flooding the banking system with $250 billion yesterday.
In terms of the economy, as Tony alluded to, there's some talk that the rebuilding process could actually shake Japan out of its the economic funk it's been in for some time now.
The problem with creative destruction is that it is destruction.
My next question is about the labor theory of value, just to kind of get our hands on how capital produces value, and it does it through labor. Has labor always been the source of value, or is this unique to capitalism?
Labor has always created useful things that people have valued, but that's not the sort of value that Marx is talking about. And this is often confusing to people because we can use the word value in lots of different ways. The way that Marx is talking about value is one that's specific to capitalism. When the products of labor meet in the marketplace and form quantitative relationships with each other, specifically, like if I say my coffee mug is equal to like two books, or a car is equal to, you know, 500 books. These are sort of objective value relations. They're objective because even if I like coffee more than cars, cars are always going to be objectively. My subjective valuations don't have any effect on that. It's only a certain point in history in which the products of labor. In which labor is labor for exchange and not for use, right? And that's the point in which we have we're selling labor in the marketplace, and we have the exchange of commodities. That's specific to capitalism. So Marx's theory of value is analyzing that specific phenomenon, and he's saying there are specific things about that organization of society that are not unique to previous societies. Even though previous societies still had labor, and even though sometimes they had money and they had tools and they had property and all sorts of things, it's the production for exchange that is unique and needs to be analyzed. And he says when we examine this phenomenon of production for exchange, we see all these social contradictions that emerge that are unique to capitalism, contradictions between people and their products. For the first time in history where our product is alienated from us, it becomes this autonomous force in the marketplace that acts back upon us. And there's actually an inversion of the subject-object relationship. And instead of the subject sort of having authority over the object has authority over the subject. It's dictating our lives to us. It's telling us, it's, you know, making us work for it instead of it working for us. And it becomes objectified also in a class society, which a small group of people own the labor of other people, and the vast majority of people have to work for their wealth. And sort of the ultimate form of this sort of alienated product is capital, which is this self-expansion of value for its own sake. This sort of this blind, cold, market-driven monster constantly expanding, sort of devouring human labor for no real human purpose, but just for the purpose of capital.
In the feudal system, you know, when the serfs would be working the land for the aristocracy, for their feudal lord, they were producing, you know, food stuff for use and not for exchange?
Right. So, like, if you're in a serf and you're working the land, you, like, work part of the year on your own land and you work part of the year on your landlord's land. The appropriation of the surplus is very apparent. It's, like, easy to see that you're being exploited.
And I guess my question is, what would the feudal lord do with the surplus? I mean, was he taking that and just feeding the people in his castle, or was he exchanging it for other goods?
I mean, I think there is exchange. There's a sort of exchange between communities to some extent. I mean, but it's not. But the point of the production is not primarily for exchange. Exchange is sort of like a secondary aspect of like the whole community, instead of like something that in a capitalist system defines the basic interrelations within a community. Marx sees like an emergent quality there. Those sort of exchanges between communities eventually sort of create these pressures that create masses of wealth that become capital and break down the borders of feudalism eventually until capitalism sort of emerges out of that. So you're right that process of exchange has some sort of like emergent qualities in it that I think lead into capitalism, but they're not capital in the same sense, because they're not disciplining labor in the same way that they do in a capitalist society.
In other words, like in the feudal system, the reason why you were working the land was not in order to help the feudal lord exchange his goods, and then you could make a small wage based on that or something, which is this system. It was you were doing that because the aristocracy was simply in a superior position, closer to God somehow, closer to the king who's closer to God, and this was your social role, and it was kind of openly a social role that you were participating in, rather than an economic role. Or
I think that's true. And the sort of labor time you put into working on the land didn't have like a direct market, wasn't sort of directly linked to the market. It was sort of maybe indirectly linked to a very sort of vague and like underdeveloped market that was several stages away. It wasn't like the product of your labor every day was meeting in the market to compare with the products of everybody else's labor and establishing some sort of like a sense of like average labor time. There was not this sort of constant discipline of your labor to the needs of market exchange, because you as a feudal peasant weren't getting a wage that you had to go then spend to get your means of subsistence. You were making your means of subsistence. You could take as long as you wanted to do that. As long as you had time to work in the landlord's land and make some extra surplus crop for him, it's for a few months out of the year. We have to look at what type of work we're talking about, and how that work is being organized and disciplined to really understand what the difference is between feudalism and capitalism.
We have seen that exchange value implies that commodities have an intrinsic value expressed in different exchange ratios. This value is not use value or exchange value, but a third thing. What is this value? Where does it come from? Marx argues that it is the labor time that society devotes to the production of these commodities that accounts for this underlying value. Commodities that take more labor to create have more value than ones that take less labor. As labor becomes more productive, as it becomes easier to produce things, their value falls. But what is Marx's justification for choosing labor as this third thing?
There are lots of properties common to all commodities, besides the fact that they are products of labor. Marx could just as easily have said scarcity or utility were this third thing. This, of course, is the approach taken by marginal utility theory, which argues that it is our subjective desires for commodities in relation to their scarcity that determines their value. Why is it that Marx doesn't take this route?
For one, scarcity and utility cannot be understood without reference to labor. The amount of a commodity that exists at any point in time is clearly related to the amount of labor that has been devoted to producing that commodity. And utility isn't just some abstract individual substance detached from the labor process. Subjective desire only counts economically when it is turned into real action, when we buy things in the market. The only way to enter the market as a purchaser is also to enter it as a seller. We must sell the products of our labor and then use this money to buy the commodities we desire. The only means of attaining our desires is the buying and selling of the products of labor. Not only does capitalism shape our desires, it determines how we go about attaining our desires. But there is an even more important reason why Marx doesn't choose scarcity and utility as the determinants of this underlying value. Utility and scarcity both describe the relation between individuals and objects. Marx is interested in the relations between people. If we think back to Marx's argument about commodity fetishism, we'll remember that in a capitalist society, the relations between people take the form of relations between things. Objects appear to have power and value on their own. But this world of appearances is not the full story. These value relations between commodities are actually relations between people whose work is coordinated indirectly through commodity exchange. And this is where any social theory must begin, with a study of the productive activity of people as they work to create the world they live in. Not only is this the best starting place for an analysis of society, it is also the best starting place for a radical social theory whose aim is to investigate the possibility of changing the world. If we realize that human society is not the result of some natural or divine eternal logic, but merely the creation of our own labor, then that means that we have the power to mold and shape the society as we see fit. In a capitalist society, these creative powers take the form of an external world of value and capital that acts back upon society, shaping it against the will of its creators. Yet, in the end, the world of capital is nothing but the product of our own creation. If we truly want to change the world, it is not up to nature, God, fate, or experts, but up to us. This is the radical challenge of the law of value.
For me, having watched your videos and thinking that I've grasped it, you know, there's. It seems to me like there is just mapping out, just saying what the terms are here. There's use value, which isn't very important to Marx's theory because he's looking at capital, and then there's exchange value, and there's the surplus value that labor adds in the production process, and then there's this other thing that's just value, which is that labor value that.
Yeah, sure. Maybe I should go back and sort of try to do that, sort of define some of those basic things. So if you look at a commodity, the apparent thing upon examining it is that it has a use value and an exchange value, right? You can use it for something, and that's its use value. It has an exchange value, and what that means is that it has a quantitative relationship with other commodities. It's worth so much of some other commodity. I mean, the exchange value we're most used to thinking of is price, right? This is worth so much money. But price is just a specific type of exchange value. It's the exchange value of a commodity with money. Those are sort of the apparent things on the surface. As Marx probes against into the nature of the commodity, he argues that behind exchange value, there is something more fundamental. And that something more fundamental is what he calls value. And this value is—he's saying that exchange value is just measuring value, and what this value is a social relation. It's a relation between people that are producing things, and that's the sort of essence of what is being measured by exchange value—the relationship between producers. The reason things have value is because they require time for society to produce. That doesn't mean that there's some sort of perfect relationship where, like, the price always automatically completely corresponds to the amount of time that goes into making something. But it just means that there's sort of this attempt always being made to, like, measure the labor time of things in exchange values. But we don't see that labor time. We all we see is these objects that have prices. And that's part of the process of being alienated from our own product, is that we don't really see the people that make the things we buy or have a sense of the labor process. And when we make something, it sort of leaves our body. We don't have a sense of, like, who's buying it or how much it really even costs. It just sort of goes down the assembly line and our labor disappears from us forever. So these relationships between all these people and all their assembly lines, and they sort of, the only way they ever sort of interact with each other as producers is by taking their wage for making their widget at the assembly line and going to the grocery store and buying another widget for with their wage. That's the only really relationship between producers. And that's
just to talk about kind of one of the symptoms of that is that I think that even amongst people who consider themselves to be progressives and on the left, there's a tendency to seek simplicity and to retreat from commodities in an attempt to get back to something substantial, something that doesn't make you feel alienated the way, you know, the going to the grocery store might. So, like, the positive side of this is I know people who are, like, growing their own food. You know, I have some chickens. This is a way to see my productive labor in terms of use value immediately. But what that also kind of tends to reinforce is this idea that we are separate from each other, that there's this world of alienated stuff, the economy, which really isn't about what we produce. And then we can retreat to our kind of private spaces where we might be able to produce something for use again.
I mean, it's a totally understandable reaction to the alienation, the psychological alienation of commodity production. People just want to, like, get their hands in dirt and, like, make their own stuff. We probably all know people do that or do some of that ourselves. Of course, like, no one knows anyone who actually can really do that, right? This is, like, sort of something for hobbyists to do on the side. Like, people are still, like, selling their labor time to a capitalist, and they're still buying most of the things they eat and clothe themselves with. Even, like, back to the landers who, like, move out to a farm to make most of their stuff. Like, they have to buy land and owe money to a bank, and they have to sell the products of their farm, like, in some farmer's market for some yuppie somewhere in the city, and like there's no escape from the social relations of capital. We really can't retreat as individuals.
And that desire to is kind of counterproductive, really.
Yeah, I mean, my people feel like, I think, you know, because really, like, the alienation that Marx is talking about is more than just some sort of psychological alienation. It's not just, the problem isn't just that you feel bad, you feel alienated. It's that you're objectively alienated, that, like, the market has more control over your life than you do. And that's not something that, and you might be able to, like, you could do lots of subjective things to make yourself feel better about that. You could, you know, take psychiatric drugs or smoke a lot of weed or drink a lot, or you could go and do some organic farmings on Saturday mornings. But, like, you're not really going to change the objective nature of that alienation.
And to reinforce this, the objective nature of alienation, you can kind of see it at work if you are a worker and you're trying to kind of get out from under having to work for somebody else. I'm unemployed right now, so I'm thinking of ways to make money. And what I keep running up against is socially necessary labor time. You know, I have all this, all these ideas, but I can't produce anything on the scale that would be necessary to really even just support myself, even in the market, right? It seems like I have to submit to some larger mechanism in order to survive.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought up the socially necessary labor time, because that's a really good point. You know, oftentimes in a capitalist society, this thing is dangled in front of us. This fantasy of self-employment is dangled in front of us. You know, be your own boss. Wouldn't it be great to, like, sort of have your own hours and be your own boss and work out of your house? And wouldn't it be so liberating? But, like, most of the people that we know that are their own boss, and I'm partly self-employed myself, it can be a really brutal lifestyle. I mean, and that's because, for one thing, like, cooperative labor is always going to be more productive than an individualist labor. Sort of a basic, you know, statement about human labor. When people get together and work on something, they're going to be more productive. Their labor is going to be more productive. They're going to be able to outproduce individuals. You know, groups of people, with the help of, like, you know, capital investment and, like, machines and technology, are going to outproduce individuals in their homes any day of the week. You're always going to be doing way more work than is socially necessary if you are self-employed. And that's because in a capitalist society, like, what determines the value of something isn't, like, the private labor time you as an individual put into something. It's the social average, the average amount of time it takes to create something. And Marx calls this socially necessary labor time. And this is a basic result of the fact that the products of labor meet in the marketplace, and the market is this process of social averaging. And this is a process that is constantly revolutionizing the productivity of labor, and as capitalists compete to lower the socially necessary labor time. You know, labor is becoming more and more efficient, and we're able to produce more and more with less labor. But still, we never see, as a society, the liberating effects of this, right? We're always being told that technology is making our labor more productive, and we're approaching this new amazing sci-fi future. But the more sci-fi our world gets, the more we're still always working the same amount or more, and our lives are just as crappy.
And that's because we don't have access to the means of production. We don't get to direct how things are produced. We just get to compete, you know, as laborers in the market.
Yeah, and it's not like the problem of human society is that we just don't have enough gadgets, or our gadgets aren't great enough. It's that we don't have control over our lives, that we don't get to choose work that is fulfilling to us and would make our life better. I kind of like to call the paradox the cell phones in the ghetto paradox. Like, if you walk through the ghetto, you see people talking on cell phones and using all the sorts of high-tech stuff that people in the ghetto didn't have access to 10 years ago. But it's still the ghetto. And we still call it the ghetto, and people are still trapped in the ghetto, and their lives are still just as bad as it was before the cell phones. They're still below the poverty level. Their lives are still, you know, defined by their poverty. And you give them, you know, they could all be driving BMWs tomorrow once BMWs became really cheap. But it would still be the ghetto.
Right. And this is something that, you know, apologists for the current system will always point out, is like, you know, our standard of living is always increasing. Think about all the things that you have today, all the, you know, the television sets and the refrigerators and all of these things that, you know, even kings didn't have in earlier periods. And And what's left out is basically social power.
Yeah, social power and freedom. Mm-hmm. Like, just having a cell phone doesn't make you more free. It doesn't give you more power over your life. It doesn't give you more autonomy to, like, choose the sort of life you want to live.
It is just me and you. Close your eyes. I want you to listen. Happiness is...
Hey, that's Harder!
Yeah, it's the official tabletop version of the arcade game.
You play the same! Did you get it?
Mr. Arcade is here!
Galaxian, it's mine! Pac-Man!
You want to take it home?
Yeah! My own Pac-Man!
Mr. Arcade, could you?
Donkey Kong?
Donkey Kong,
the official tabletop version.
Frogger, Donkey Kong, and Midway's Pac-Man and Galaxian. The arcade games you can take home with you from Coleco.
Happiness is...
With us now is Laura Hoon, author of a brilliant, excellent, tremendous work, 10,000 Things to Be Happy About. Because we can never be happy enough.
You know, the first video that I ran across of yours was called Manufacturing Consent, which was, I think, a very smart video for you to make. Because, you know, I wasn't looking for you.
Looking for Noam Chomsky, right?
Looking for Chomsky.
Yeah.
But one of the things you point out is that our whole notion of freedom is kind of shaped by the market. So when you're talking to me about, oh, we don't have freedom and these products don't give us that, I almost feel like the temptation or the danger is that we start thinking about living our own lives in terms of something that will come to us whole, like a commodity, you know, that isn't a back and forth social relationship, you know, but instead is something complete and individual and atomized in itself.
Yeah, this is a really good question. It's really interesting. And my answer is that there's nothing but freedom, which is like universal and timeless. And there's nothing about anything that's universal and timeless, except for a basic sort of, I would say, like a fact about humans and society, and that's that we produce the world we live in, but the world we live in also creates us, and that this relationship isn't just sort of an individual relationship, it's a social relation. We as collectively are producing a society, and that society collectively is like creating who we are, creates our desires, and also creates the way we act out those desires. And each society is sort of defined by the way in which we are creating and being created. And those ways of being created and being created, Marx calls modes of production. It's the creative activity of people. The specific form it takes is a mode of production, a specific way of producing. In a capitalist society, that's production for exchange. That's sort of what defines the mode of production. Also things like private property and capitalist state and all these other things. But it's like the mode of production, which is producing a society, or just sort of defines... The capitalist mode of production is defined by this production for exchange. Anyway, on to this question about freedom. So what's interesting about the capitalist mode of production is that it generates certain ideas of freedom that are historically new, but it doesn't allow us to fulfill them. So there's a contradiction between the sort of ideas of freedom and individuality and our ability to actually have them. This contradiction sort of demands that we probe into it and examine it more fully. And upon probing into it, and we realize that sort of this contradiction is emblematic of all these other contradictions in society between classes, between use value and exchange value, between booms and busts, between people and machines. It sort of has all these different aspects. And in examining it, we can also come up with this analytical possibility. We can sort of ask this question: what would it be like to actually have freedom? Like, what would it take to like overcome these contradictions? well, we it would mean we have to have a different mode of production, one that generates a higher, some sort of synthesis, some sort of better freedom than the sort of unfulfilled bourgeois freedoms we have in our society. That's what I think the Communist Project is about, and the Marxist Project, about trying to figure out, you know, how what sort of society would be able to transcend the sort of limited, contradictory notion of freedom we have in a capitalist society.
Only through an understanding of the activity of people as they shape their world, and the way in which the particular mode of that production shapes the individual, can we understand scarcity and utility. This makes labor the obvious focal point for our investigation into the value relations that make up a capitalist society. Labor is the way we create the objective world we encounter, and the way we create ourselves. It makes sense that this notion of value might not be intuitive for some to accept. In a capitalist society, we are separated from our labor. Our working power is a commodity that we sell to a capitalist. The capitalist owns our labor and the product of that labor. Our labor must take the form of a commodity with a market value before it becomes social labor. Value obscures the social nature of our labor. As you may know, Marx's bourgeois predecessors, Adam Smith and David Ricardo, amongst others, subscribed to a labor theory of value. You might think, then, that this means that they too had a proper dialectical understanding of the relation between production and exchange. But this is not the case. Marx reproaches both Smith and Ricardo for reducing form to content. The distinction turns out to be crucial. The content of value is labor. By this we mean that the social substance that makes up value is labor. But we don't see this content when we examine a commodity. No matter how we may poke, prod, smell it, or take it apart, we can't see its social content. That's because this content takes a material form. This form is exchange value. When we say it takes a material form, we mean this literally. The value of the book takes on the form of pencils, or tires, or baritones. So, Marx makes a distinction between the content of value, labor, and the form of value, which is exchange value. This means that value and exchange value are different, and since price is just a special form of exchange value, price and value are different. Prices are just the surface appearance of value, but this value has no fixed physical form independent of its material expression in pencils, tires, or money. For Smith and Ricardo, price is immediately identifiable with value. This is what Marx means when he says they reduced form to content. They treated the content of value, labor, as if it immediately had an exchange value. They failed to understand that value is a process whereby labor takes on the material form of exchange value. But these exchange ratios are not value. They are merely the expression of this third thing, called intrinsic value. This allows Marx to examine the ways in which prices fluctuate around values, which allows him to solve some theoretical problems that eluded his predecessors. It also leads him to ask an important question that Smith and Ricardo had never asked. What type of labor produces value? Because Smith and Ricardo saw labor and price as identical, they assumed all labor, in all times, created value. As we know, these sort of appeals to universality and eternal concepts are problematic. It is only a specific type of labor that produces value, labor for exchange.
In case it's not obvious, there's a central ideological issue at stake in this distinction between the general and the particular. It's quite simple. Things that are universal can't be changed. There's no use organizing, studying, reading, or complaining about them. If human beings are always a certain way, then that's just how it is. But if we want to change the world, we need to know what aspects of our reality are not universal. What things are merely the product of the organization of our social relations? what things might change under a different type of organization.
In a capitalist society, much of the world of appearances comes from our experience in the market, in the realm of exchange. But from this one-sided perspective, we aren't able to see the historic specificity of these market experiences. Without a perspective of the type of productive relations that underlie the freedom, equality, and individuality of the market, we end up making universalizing and inadequate generalizations about human nature. Such a one-sided perspective makes it seem as if we are trapped in the present, as if the problems of today are universal problems of all time, unable to be transcended.
Well, that just about wraps up the 96th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. You'll hear more from Brendan Cooney next week, and maybe even find out just what is to be done. This week, you heard the Super Mario Brothers theme, the NBC Nightly News theme, clips from the Zach Galifianakis film Visioneers, as well as several clips from the YouTube videos of Brendan Cooney. Right now, you're listening to Paul McCartney's Ode to Commodities, entitled Junk. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Miriam with this week's Titanic Factoid.
Experienced travelers sailing first class aboard the Titanic or other large transatlantic liners enjoyed on their first night out consulting the passenger list. This passenger list had been specially printed in a neat little booklet by the White Star Line that included all of the first class passengers. This included all the prominent names. Also, interestingly, the on board the Titanic anyways, 31 maids, valets, and personal servants that were accompanying the first class passengers. People liked to look and see who they might know or might have heard of who were also traveling with them. There were a few people traveling in first class, however, on board the Titanic who had their names deliberately omitted from the list. These were George Bradley, C.H. Romaine, and Harry Homer. These three men were sailing on the Titanic under aliases, and they were notorious card sharps, hoping to make a killing, no pun intended there. There was another professional gambler by the name of Jay Yates, who was also crossing. He was going by the name J.H. Rogers. So these gamblers were a fixture on passenger liners, and perhaps still are. They were generally known to the pursers on large ships, but as long as nothing too bad ever happened, the stakes were not too high, or nobody was victimized too badly, the gamblers' activities generally were overlooked. The White Star Line, however, did take a precaution. A warning was printed and inserted into the passenger list, and it stated that professional gamblers might be on board, and discouraged people from, quote, games of chance, as being likely to afford these individuals special opportunities for taking advantage of others. This warning, admittedly, was more for the protection of the White Star Line than it was for its passengers.